Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this Wednesday edition, 101.3 KPCG. President Trump, he is defending the firing of the former FBI director. Take a look at that headline. Also, you might be surprised by what Chicago inmates can do when they're in jail. Some people want pets, but they don't want kids, but they want to treat the pets like kids. Interesting write-up. Also, the threat of a dirty bomb, it's real, and probably more of a threat than we realize. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. This is Trumpet Radio Live on the Wednesday edition. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and email us anything you'd like to. Comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today as well. And I was watching a little basketball last night. The Spurs were playing the Houston Rockets. Pulled out an overtime victory. But the most important part of all of it was that Manu Ginobili, who's 39 years old, dunked the basketball. And the bench acted like they had seen something they'd never seen before. So that's 1 year older than me, so it gave me hope. I'm gonna start stretching.
Yeah, well, he also had the game-winning block. That's what I initially thought you were going to bring up. So he contributed in a pretty big way last night, and like every year, we speculate on if it's his final year, but he keeps on contributing in such a big way and helping them always be in the championship mix every year that it's hard to imagine him retiring now.
He's so smart. He's a smart and crafty player. I've never been necessarily a big fan, but I respect the way he plays. And anytime somebody's a little older and they're still doing it, you think, wow, there you go. Gives you some hope. They're starting up this new 3-on-3 basketball league with former NBA players. And I would think it actually be kind of interesting. And one of the reasons they're doing it, besides they just want to make money, is that they say, you know, a lot of these players that fans still like, they can still play. It's just that they can't play 82 games or whatever, the 81 games, whatever the regular season is. And I guess it's 82.
Yeah.
And they can't, you know, they can't play the full court, full on, whole. But, they're in their late 30s, 40s. They can still play and play very well. It's just they can't do it to the extent that they do in the NBA. And I thought, hey, that's actually not a bad idea, because I still want to see some of those old guys play a little bit.
Oh yeah,
and they're still good. It's not like they've forgotten how to do it. It's just you lose that endurance.
Yeah, and last I checked with that Big Three league, I don't know if they had the dates and the cities nailed down yet. But if that were anywhere within like 5 or 6 hours of here, I'd probably try to go see it. That would be worth it to me.
Yeah, they got a TV contract. I think I forget who's carrying it, but they've got like a season, an actual season. They had a draft, and it's some former NBA guys. Allen Iverson, probably the most famous guy that's playing. And so, anyway, kind of interesting. You can still do it, just can't run as far. They'll have to do that for other sports too. You know, where you want to see like your old favorite quarterback. But he just can't take a hit anymore, so he's got to, I don't know, touch football or something.
That's what's so tough about these professional sports is just the wear and tear that they go through to play at such a high level as frequently as they play, especially in basketball, hockey, baseball, where they're playing every night or every other night, every couple nights. You know, at least football is only 16 times a year, but even still, once a week you're taking hits that are on the level of a car crash.
Yeah.
So any of those sports, it does wear you out.
I've seen interviews with Brett Favre, the old Packer quarterback, and he said, oh, he can still make all the throws. He just can't take the hit.
Yeah.
So he could still do it. And then there's, once in a while, you'll have videos show up on YouTube of like semi-pro leagues, which are extremely, extremely good. It's usually college players and ex-pros. And you'll have, former NBA guys that are in their 40s and they're still beating everybody. So it's not like they're not good anymore, but they're just not at that elite level in terms of youth and skill, I guess. Lots going on in the news beyond the sporting world. The biggest story, of course, is that President Trump fired the former FBI director. James Comey. So that was everywhere, all over the news. It still is, and there's all sorts of talk about what's going on with that. This is a write-up from Reuters. It says, Trump defends firing of FBI director. He pledges far better replacement. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday defended his firing of the FBI's director, blasting Democratic critics, and I think there's some Republican critics too, who decried the move and vowing to replace James Comey with someone, quote, far better, which, of course, you would say. You're not going to say, I'm going to replace him with someone that probably is not as good. You know?
There will probably be just as many scandals.
Yeah. That's a claim that, you know, they're going to make any one way or the other. And the president tweeted this. Comey lost the confidence of almost everyone in Washington, Republican and Democrat alike. When things calm down, they will be thanking me. He wrote in a series of posts on Twitter one day after he fired the top U.S. law enforcement official. Comey had been leading a probe into the Trump 2016 presidential campaign's possible collusion with Russia. You know, so that's kind of the way the media is taking it. I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not. It depends on what you read. You know, some outlets are saying this is a terrible that he fired him. Other outlets are saying it was coming. So kind of depends on what you read about that. I'm sure there'll be a lot more on the Trumpet.com and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show in the days ahead. But it's pretty fresh news at this point.
Yeah, he definitely brought himself under fire, James Comey, that is, from both sides, because even just the fact that he would announce there's an investigation underway doesn't seem necessary for the FBI. They could just investigate whatever the issue is without telling everybody, because, of course, whenever he announced that Hillary Clinton would be investigated with the email issue, then all the Republicans were really upset when he supposedly didn't find anything, even though maybe there was evidence that should have gotten her in some trouble. And then, of course, about a week before the election, he announces that he was reopening the investigation, which then all the Democrats decided that was the turning point of the entire election. It's strange now that the Democrats would be upset that he got fired when they thought that Mr. Trump only won the presidency because of James Comey.
Yeah, they've definitely flipped their opinion on it in
because
some way.
Mr. Trump did it. It doesn't matter what he does. I mean, even if they're going to blame that guy for swaying the election, apparently that's not enough to get him fired because Mr. Trump is the person who did it.
Yeah, it seems to that seems to be the main issue far as the way their opinion would fall and on the situation. So anyway, we'll see how that develops in the days ahead. Here's an interesting little note from CNN.com. The deadliest places in the world based on the number of fatalities per country. In 2016... the worst, I don't think this would be a surprise, the deadliest place in the world is Syria. 50,000 people killed last year. Mexico's number two, 23,000. That, I don't know if that's surprising. I guess it could be a little surprising. There's a lot of violence there. I would think most of it drug-related. Mm-hmm. But to be number two in the world, that is a little bit startling because there are other areas that do have some military conflicts going on. So Mexico's number two, the second deadliest place in the world, and I think you can see why the U.S. would want to have caution as to who's coming in from that area when you look at these numbers.
Well, same with the Syrian refugees. It's amazing how both of those top two countries with people killed are the specific countries where the U.S. is trying to proceed with caution about who gets in. The refugees are obviously in a horrible situation there, but there's different arguments about how to solve that problem. And then, of course, down in Mexico, a lot of people from South and Central America are coming up and trying to get through Mexico and into the U.S. It's not just Mexicans who could be the problem there. It's really a lot of violent people who are coming up the pipeline there.
Yeah, it's a corridor for access into the U.S., or at least it has been. Although some reports say it's settling down a little bit, mm-hmm. just because of the threat of enforcing some laws. Iraq was number three, 17,000 fatalities in 2016. Afghanistan, just behind them at number four, 16,000. And then Yemen with 7,000. So all Middle Eastern countries, and then Mexico there is number two. So those are the deadliest conflicts in the world in 2016. And they only give you the top five there. It'd be interesting to see how the U.S. came in. And I don't know exactly how they're figuring all of these numbers, but just murder rates alone, you think we wouldn't be too far behind.
Yeah, we already definitely have it bad enough as it is without letting in some more dangerous people. But even if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan on that list, Both of those were places where America failed militarily. Even Yemen, they've allowed radical Islamic strongholds to take place or to take root there. So America has ties to really all of those places, either in the way that they have failed to act or in the way they have failed to enforce their border.
I saw a really interesting news story. It's from the Associated Press in relation to what some of the young boys are experiencing over in Iraq because of ISIS. And they had a group of boys that were taken captive for a period of time by ISIS, and then I guess were released or escaped or something. And so they were interviewing them about their experiences, and of course they were indoctrinated into the ISIS philosophy, which is basically they were trying to make them into suicide bombers. And so you have very young children, 10 and under, and they're trying to teach them, and they're telling them, look, you know, you're going to be a suicide bomber, hopefully. And the kids were kind of scared, you know, and they said, well, do you want to go to, you know, I don't know how they phrased it, if it was paradise or heaven or what they said, but do you want to go to heaven? Or you want to go to hell, basically. You know, and the kids don't even know what to say. Some of them are 5, 6 years old. So you can just see what the problems that are happening there in Iraq on the ground level, too. And again, it gets back to the failure to really finish the job over there. And then you have all these other terrorist groups pop up, and you have situations like that still going on.
Even to the level of announcing ahead of time when we're going to remove troops or reduce troops in those areas, giving the enemy hope that they can just withstand our barrage and then come back stronger after the fact. So we really haven't handled a lot of those situations very intelligently. On the other hand, it's difficult to even try to figure out what the solution might be. If you talk to an average Iraqi, they have high hostility against Americans. So it's not really a place where Americans would want to be around for too long, because they're obviously going to be a constant target there.
So that's not good news for some of those nations, those where the deadly conflicts are happening. Here's an interesting story. I've never really heard of somebody doing this before, but I've seen movies on people climbing Everest and documentaries and read some books about it. It's for those that want to climb mountains, it is like the ultimate, I guess. If you can climb Everest, I think somebody just died trying to do it. It was an older person up in their 70s or something. And basically, if you're going to climb Everest, you have to pay the piper in a lot of ways. Physically, it takes a toll. You have to prepare, but you have to pay money too, because you need to be guided up to the top. So what happens if you go there and realize you don't have enough money, but you want to climb it anyway? That's the question. What do you think someone would do?
Well, maybe they would try to trade some of their items, something like that. I don't know.
If they had enough, maybe. Or, in the case of this guy, they would just try to sneak up there by themselves.
Of course. I should have known.
Climber caught hiding in a cave to avoid paying the £8,000 to climb Everest.
Wow.
An additional £8,000. I think he already had paid some. They say, and this is from Yahoo UK, everyone knows that climbing Mount Everest is not easy, but it's also not cheap. Foreign climbers who want to scale the 8,848-meter, that's 29,030 feet, by the way, peak, must pay the Nepalese government £8,000 to gain a permit. So, yeah, it's hard enough to climb. Why do you got to pay all this money for the permit to try it? But that's how they make their money there, I guess. But this South African adventurer wanted the glory of scaling the world's highest mountain without having to fork out the cash to do it. Sadly for Ryan Sean Davey, who's 43, who had climbed alone as far as Camp 2, which is 6,400 meters, he didn't have the money that he needed. So he tried to do it by himself, and he got caught hiding in a cave up there on the mountain, and now he's facing a very large fine.
I never actually thought of the fact that it would be that expensive. That just seems like an unnecessary restriction. But I've even heard of, obviously, you have to get a hunting license or a fishing license. You know, this is another instance where nature is involved and you have to pay somebody for it. So really anyone who, I guess, gets control of those things could charge whatever they want to. I guess that's fair, right?
Yeah, I think it's probably does two things. One, it's good revenue for them, for the country, but also it does make people really have to be serious about it. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't any fee, you know, it'd be easy enough to say, let's go climb Everest, and you don't know what you're getting into, right. You die.
That's true.
Even these people that know what they're doing, they oftentimes don't make it. Although it is funny because I think they're called the Sherpas, the ones that send up. Those are like the real climbers because they like just scale up there and they make the course for everybody else. I'm like, well, that's the guy that climbed Everest. You just followed the ropes.
But right. They do it all the time.
They do it all the time. And I guess they're probably acclimated somewhat to it. But so this guy, somebody that was a government liaison at the base camp says, I saw him alone near base camp. So I approached him and he ran away. I followed him with my friend and found him hiding in a cave nearby. He had set up camp in an isolated place to avoid government officials. So Davey, the guy that was hiding on Facebook, he later wrote, this news is probably going to make a lot of people upset with me, and I really hope you'll all forgive me. He said that his expedition had taken a very bad turn. He says, I'm going to be honest in saying that when I arrived at base camp, it became evident that I didn't have nearly enough money for a solo permit because of hidden costs. So he says. And even if I did, they would have declined it because I had no previous mountaineering experience on record. That's another reason you probably shouldn't climb Everest. He said, I took a chance and spent the little money I had on more gear to climb and practice on the surrounding peaks for acclimating in preparing for a stealth entry onto Everest. How many people have climbed Everest stealthily? That's the question. He says, unfortunately, the system caught up with me and I was eventually captured by the mountain orcs. I'm assuming he's taking a dig at him there. I don't think that's what they're called.
Orcs are just hideous creatures, yeah. Too. That's a big insult.
He was captured by the mountain orcs after two entries into the ice falls and managing an ascent of 24,000 feet, he claims. Expedition companies, he says, have no time for wannabe Everesters with no money, so someone turn me in. So that's his take on it. So what happens is he could be banned from Nepal for 5 years, face a 10-year ban on climbing in the country, and could be fined £16,000, which is double the cost of the permit.
Yeah, the money's the big deal. I don't think too many people would be upset from being banned from climbing a mountain, but the money that's pretty huge. That's a tough thing to deal with. It always seems like we have funny stories about South Africans coming up. I married a South African. She was just saying the other day how they're pretty crazy over there. They're pretty unique people. You know, tricking the Huffington Post into posting an article about denying white men the right to vote and things like that. Which I don't know. Some of these stories to me don't seem that outrageous. It seems like they're just trying to get on with life without all these harsh regulations.
Yeah, the fact that it's a South African kind of an adventurer type individual,
yeah.
Like it doesn't surprise me. You know, I'm like, yeah, I could see somebody doing that.
He just wants to climb a mountain.
Just wants to get
up
there.
I mean, they probably wrestle lions with their bare hands, and so that's not too big of a deal for them.
Yeah, so I guess I would have thought that there could be a penalty for trying to just climb on your own, but I hadn't thought much of it. Usually people do pay a climbing company of some kind to help them. You have to pay attention to the weather. You have to know what you're doing. In most cases, people don't climb Everest unless they know what they're doing on some level for their own safety because you can die up there. I mean, it's not like just taking a day hike to the top of a, you know, national park mountain or something. I mean, this is life and death. So anyway, the guy is facing this huge fine after being caught by the mountain orcs, as he said.
Hopefully they have some mercy on him. He just wanted to have an adventure and obviously, he didn't know. He probably showed up at the base camp and didn't even know about any of the fees, I would guess.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. What? I've got to pay to get up there now? So, yeah, a very interesting story there. This one's this is a sad note. I think you know ESPN broadcaster Chris Berman. He's been on ESPN for a long time, does a lot of football coverage. His wife, Kathy, died in a car crash. The wife of longtime ESPN broadcaster Chris Berman has died in a traffic crash in Connecticut. State police say the 67-year-old Catherine Ann Berman of Cheshire was one of two victims in the two-vehicle crash at about 2:15 yesterday. ESPN President John Skipper said in a statement the death is a, quote, devastating tragedy and difficult to comprehend, and pledged to give Chris Berman the love and support he will surely need in this hour or so. Always sad to hear about an accident like that, but I think people probably know Chris Berman. He's been pretty popular on ESPN.
Yeah, he's a legend. He has some of the greatest football calls when he's covering the highlights and things like that. He does that thing where he goes, whoop!
Yep.
That's my favorite. And he says, no one circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah.
So obviously that stands out to me. But it is really sad even to just put a personal or to just to put a face on a tragedy like that when you actually have seen that person and you feel like you have kind of a connection with that person through the TV.
Mm-hmm.
His own wife died. And so it's really, really sad to think about that.
Yeah. So anyway, hopefully he'll do all right through that that tragedy, but that's never expected when something like that happens. This one is an interesting note. You might be surprised to learn that Chicago inmates can now order pizza directly to their cells. Does that surprise you?
Yes, actually.
Inmates in the Cook County Jail can now order pizza delivered directly to their cells. The medium security prison has allowed pretrial detainees to use their commissary to purchase pizza cooked on the premise. So it's not everybody. There's a little bit of a difference there. It's called the Recipe for Change program, run by local restaurant owner Chef Bruno Abate. He looks to teach inmates skills that they can use when they are released. So there could be some benefit to this, I guess. The pizzas cost between $5 and $7. That's a bargain. That's a bargain. That's like Little Caesars.
Although, what do they make in prison? Like maybe a dollar an hour or less?
2 cents an hour. Oh, I don't know. And the selection, you get, there's a selection of 6 different pizzas, including classics like plain margarita and sausage. They say this isn't coddling the detainees. The sales would go towards funding the program itself. The program has been in place since April the 20th, and as of Monday, 208 pies have been sold. Smith says a food truck serving food cooked by inmates is also in the works, although it's only in the developmental stage. So, I don't know that I'd, you know, not that it's being sold to the public. I think I'd be leery to buy pizza made by jail inmates, but, but who knows? So it sounds kind of outrageous, but there might be some good to the program.
So the inmates are making the pizzas for other inmates only, or is it for people outside the prison as well?
Well, it seems like it's, from what I can gather, that it's mainly for people inside.
Okay.
Like it's sort of a, you know, it's a work program where you can learn a skill. Like, okay, so you get out and you make pizzas. I mean, it's something, you know, or a food truck or whatever. So, but yeah, you know, that would be a really good day if you're looking for a bright spot when you're in prison. Get a little pizza coming.
Yeah.
That would brighten the day for sure.
That actually does seem like a really smart program because of the fact that some of the inmates are being put to work. If it were just none of them working and they could all just sit around and order pizza from Domino's,
right.
Maybe that would be a little extreme.
Have it delivered by a drone. Fly it in, drop it into the prison there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Dwight Fulton, Grant Turgeon with you here today. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program coming up. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Richard Palmer today talked quite a bit about communism, and that ties into the Trumpet Hour as well. Trumpet Hour host Joel Hilliker has a conversation with a former communist, Eugene Yelchin, who's written a children's book about communism, Breaking Stalin's Nose, I believe is the title of it. And really interesting conversation. Make sure you hear that today on KPCG. And if you can't catch it when we play it live, then you can always get the archives at thetrumpet.com or kpcg.fm. He's got a neat accent, too. Mr. Yelchin, that is. Also, the top stories from thetrumpet.com today. 40% of Germans agree with anti-Semitic statement. And related to that, never show that you are a Jew and old, a new reality in Germany. Those are the top stories today. And also a lot of coverage about Melanie Phillips, who is a Guardian columnist and written a new book. And she was here at Armstrong Auditorium, Armstrong College, and talked to the Trumpet staff. And there's a lot about that also. A lot going on at thetrumpet.com.
Yeah, it's a really good website. I think it's improved so much lately just because of all the coverage. And beneath every story, they have a couple links that would relate, you know, past material that we've put up there. So it really should be increasing the audience pretty quickly, I would think.
Yeah, a lot of good info there. Grant, you've got a really interesting write-up. This is from The Federalist. Apparently this is a thing. I didn't know too much about it, but this is a sort of an opinion piece, I guess. And the guy's title is Having Pets Instead of Kids Should Be Considered a Psychiatric Disorder. I'm sure he's going to have some that disagree with that. He says in the byline, by deferring kids for, quote, fur babies, which I had never heard of. I guess those are pets that you treat like kids. The dog boomer generation is missing out on the real joys of parenthood and pets. What's going on?
Well, he is talking about the millennial generation. They have chosen to indefinitely postpone having children, yet they still feel the unshakable urge to parent. So they turn those parenting instincts to their pets. And really the only way that millennials have outpaced the previous generation is in pet ownership, not car ownership, not, you know, not the level of job, not home ownership. It's pet ownership. And at the same time, the number of kids has gone down and the age of marriage has gotten older and older.
You know, now that you're talking about this, I think about this commercial that's on lately and I find it disturbing. It's for a cell phone, I think. And the guy's taking pictures of him and his dog, and they always dress the same. Like, he puts them in a sweater. He wears the same type of sweater. And he refers to the dog as his son. He says, here's me and my son. Have you seen that?
It's actually mentioned in this article.
Okay, maybe,
so
yeah.
You're spot on. This is exactly what it's talking about.
And I was like, okay, I get it. The guy likes the dog and everything, but it's a dog. And
right.
The guy appears to be like mid-30s. I'm like, isn't it time to kind of get on with things? I don't know.
Yeah, it is odd and awkward to see people, even in public, who just are so obsessed with their pets that you know they think of their pets on the level of another human being, when clearly that isn't the case. Animals operate on instinct alone. If they were out in the wild, they would be killing human beings.
Yes.
So we've happened to domesticate them for our own enjoyment as animals, but not to replace human beings with those animals.
And so the point that this fellow is making here in the Federalist is that, I mean, obviously pets are great, but it's just the fact that they're sort of, they are replacing children with the pets. That's that's his, what he's not happy with.
Right. And really it's a way for millennials to feel a little bit less selfish, because these same people who have embraced having pets and then kind of putting them on a pedestal are the ones who don't have children because supposedly they're too expensive, too time consuming, and they might cramp their style.
Right.
So they feel better about themselves because at least they're taking care of an animal.
Yeah. I mean, it is true. Animals are, you do have to put some time into it, but you don't have to give them the time like you would obviously a child.
Mm-hmm.
You'd say, hey, how's it going? And you'll scratch their head and they're happy to usually sit there while you know, get on social media or whatever your day consists of. Obviously, it's different. It's companionship, but it's definitely not the same as having a child.
Exactly. And the problem is a lot of people are calling their pets children, like you said, fur babies, kids, girls, boys, and sons and daughters, and they refer to themselves as pooch parents or mommies and daddies. Those are parental terms on the level of human beings, not humans to animals, but yet we are treating animals like they're the same. There's even a story in this article about a couple at the airport that is on a video call and they're talking to their parents, so in the equivalent of the grandparents, and the grandmother is watching after a dog. So they say, hey, put our kid back on the phone. And it's really just a Labrador. It's a yellow Labrador. and they almost fell over from joy at seeing the dog back on the screen, because really they are treating their dog like a human baby. It really is a strange phenomenon that has really developed quite recently.
Yeah. So I guess that commercial that we probably a lot of people have seen, it's jumping on that trend. I just thought it was bizarre. I was like, why would they be doing that? But it's a thing. So, if you go back a little bit in time and you think, what if you went up to somebody and you were just meeting them for the first time and you say, oh, do you have any kids? And they're like, oh, two, you know, whatever. And then they pointed at him and it was like the dogs. You would think like this guy might need a little bit of help.
Right.
This is not a normal situation.
It's odd. And that ties into this viral Pinterest post recently that said, don't say I am not a mom just because my kids have four legs and fur. They are my kids and I am their mom. So really,
she gave birth to them?
Yeah, apparently we're talking about the same level of intimacy here.
Well, you know, and some people really love their pets, and that's great. And
no problem with that.
Yeah, but the difference here is that it's a substitution of an animal for a human, which right. which you can't. It just doesn't work out.
Right, and millennials are also twice as likely as baby boomers to buy clothes for their pets, which also ties into that Sprint commercial. A lot of people probably didn't even think that was strange to see because it's an $11 billion a year industry,
wow.
buying clothes for pets.
That is amazing. I always find it funny. And people have been doing that for years. I remember seeing a lady walk down the street with like a jacket, and then the dog had a matching jacket. When mm-hmm. I was a kid, I saw that, and I thought, why? The dog has fur, though. Like, he has a jacket.
Exactly.
He's probably hot. It's
totally irrelevant.
Yeah, he has a natural jacket. But I always felt bad for them because I always felt like they were constrained by the human clothing.
This article even brings that out, how these pets probably hate their owners because because they are domesticating them so far away from their natural instincts of going out in the wild. You know, if you let a dog out on a hunting trip, he would go grab the bird in his jaws and bring it right back. That's what the dog would rather do rather than walking around in a knit sweater or being pushed around in a stroller, you know, things like that. A cat goes nuts if you have a laser pointer and you point it at the wall,
yeah,
and it'll be jumping all over the room. It doesn't want to have clothes put on it necessarily.
We need to ask them, do you want the sweater? They can't say. They can't say if they want it or not. Yeah, it is really a strange phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I guess
it's not even just the owners of the pets staying on the human level while treating their animals like humans. The human owners are also lowering themselves to the level of the animal. There's a new product out. It's like a rubber tongue that you can have like an extension that you can put the rubber tongue in your mouth and then bend over and lick your cat with it. That way you're not actually getting the cat hair all over your actual tongue, but you're still making the cat feel like you're his mother or father.
Mm.
Isn't that a bit much?
Yeah, this is all eye-opening to me. I didn't know that was a thing that people mm-hmm. would be doing, but well, I guess if you can make a buck at it, you make the the accessories. Yeah, really fascinating. Things are really blurring, like normal, just everyday lines of, okay, that's the pet, that's the human, that's the, mm-hmm. that's all getting mixed together.
Right, and I've even had a friend tell me that it's pretty smart to keep dogs and cats solely on the floor. Don't even let them get up on the chair, because once they're on the chair, they think they can hop on the table when you're not looking and steal mm-hmm. some of your dinner. There are things like that where there does have to be a clear distinction between human and animal. We have dominion over the animals. We're not supposed to be on their level or raise them up to our level. It doesn't make a lot of sense like that, and it does sort of defy common sense. And especially when you think of millennials now thinking of animals as replacements for their children or even as practice babies.
Yeah.
So they try to implement parenting strategies on their dog or cat. Just to see if it might work on their kid one day. And obviously there's going to be some different reactions between an animal that was, it's accustomed to being in the wild and we've happened to domesticate it, and then a human being which knows nothing other than, or a baby which knows nothing other than whatever the dad and mom raised them to do.
There's some people that I've known over the years that had a dog, or usually a dog, I suppose, with the family for a long time, and it was really, you know, special to them. But, you know, when they would talk about, say, the animal would come up in conversation, it was always in relation to, like, the kids, you know. And that was part of the attachment, I think, that I remember when, you know, my, like, say now it's an adult child. I remember when they were young and they played with the dog, you know. So it's all part of that family experience. But this is different because it's just replacing. It's a replacement. Mm-hmm. It's not a fun addition, because it's great for kids to have pets. They learn responsibility. They learn how to care for something. It's really wonderful in a lot of cases, but this is now taking it to the next level.
Yes, and to be clear, this author even grew up with pets and he loves them too, but he does not put them on the same level as his human children. That's where it does get to a disturbing extreme. Talking about these parents who actually are thinking of their animals as practice babies, what happens when the dog scratches up the door or the cat leaves a mess of fur everywhere all over the house? do those same human beings now think that, oh, they can't handle children because the pets were too much to handle? It's comparing apples to oranges, animals to human babies. And yet, if the animals give them too much trouble, they might not even try to have a human child.
I just remember, it makes me think of those, I don't know if people actually did this, but sitcoms from when I was a kid, and they were trying to teach young people the responsibility of having a baby. So they have to carry around an egg. Yeah. Did you ever see that? I don't even know if that was real or that was just TV show stuff, but yeah. this kind of reminds me of that, mm-hmm. except now it's the animal.
Literally, we are trying to turn a lot of other things into children. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's something where, well, we don't necessarily want to have actual children, but everything about us, especially coming up on our mid-20s or our early 30s, is pointing us towards starting a family and getting a home, getting married, having children. They're going against those natural instincts and still trying to channel them in a different direction. There are also a lot of lies, though, about how expensive it is to have children. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that having a child runs somewhere between $12,000 and $15,000 a year just for one child. Most people do not have that much money to spend on just each child. So if you had two children, you'd be spending $30,000 a year just on the children, regardless of your other bills. You don't have to have, like this article brings out, Batman's bank account to raise children. There are a lot of lies out there about how children are much more expensive than they actually are, which is holding people back from having children, too.
That's interesting. You put them to work in the mines. You can earn some of that money back. Or is that not legal? I can't remember.
I forget.
Well, yeah, it's you know what it seems like? It seems like it just highlights a general trend of sort of just pretending. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a kid, you pretend. But as you become an adult, typically you don't pretend because you have to deal with a certain reality. Mm-hmm. But it seems like people are suspending that changeover, and they just are pretending. Like, well, let's pretend this is, you know, our kid, or let's mm-hmm. pretend I'm something other than what I am.
Right.
And it's just the age of magical interpretation, I guess.
Exactly. It's an age of pretending, and it also leads to just a loss of natural affection where, without going into too much detail, there's a lot of ways where we as a society would treat animals better than we would other human beings, especially if you even consider like the reaction of a news anchor to maybe like a dog fighting ring. They get more upset about that than they do about, I don't know, 15 people being shot to death in an inner city. They get more upset about mistreating animals than they do about mistreating human beings.
Yeah, I think that it does seem that way because I was just thinking about some news reports I've seen where, you know, there's usually, sadly, a story about some sort of human violence, especially a lot of times towards kids. It's just terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's just terrible, but it doesn't get as much coverage as, like, say, the animal abuse, which all of it's terrible. Right. None of it should happen. But it is interesting how the time is sort of allocated maybe a little bit more to the animal side of things.
Mm-hmm. And really, if you don't understand that humans have a much greater potential and purpose than animals do, it is easy to put animals up there on the same level. And then for a lot of people who do not really know about that purpose for human beings, they could say, well, at least I can't have an argument with an animal. I can't necessarily have all these disagreements with a pet. And so then they might even like pets even more. That's the sad part when you sort of remove God from the picture.
Right. I think it's a lot easier to get along with an animal than it is another human because there's just a different relationship there. Yeah, so that's a really, really interesting trend. It makes that commercial, I guess, make more sense to me now, the Sprint, I guess, commercial.
Yeah, they're cashing in on the disturbing trend of people making animals into basically human beings.
Wow. That's from The Federalist. Having pets instead of kids should be considered a psychiatric disorder. That's what the author says. It's an inflammatory title.
He does back it up pretty well, though. It's hard to deny what he's saying.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely something that would have been looked on very suspiciously in times gone by. But now, apparently, well, what could come up whereas anybody now would bat an eye at it? I mean, the limits seem to be kind of pushed back to where anything goes, it seems like.
That's a great point. It is to the point where no one would care about a Sprint commercial where a grown man, probably in his mid-30s, is literally calling his dog his son. That's nothing when we don't even know what a gender is anymore, for example.
Yeah. Really strange. So you can see the rest of that at the Federalist if you want to. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link, too, at thetrumpet.com, and you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to. That's at kpcgfm. And send us any comments you have. Comments at kpcg.fm. And this is the Trumpet Radio Live on the Wednesday edition. Make sure that you listen for the Key of David program that's coming up here in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily program with Richard Palmer today. And the Trumpet Hour is especially good today. There's a really interesting interview with a former communist from Russia talking about what that movement's all about. A conversation with the former communist Eugene Yelchin. And you can hear that coming up in a little bit on KPCG. If you can't catch the live play of it, you can always get the archives online at kpcg.fm. And they're also at thetrumpet.com. This is an interesting write-up today. A couple other stories to get to here in the time remaining. Something this has been talked about by thetrumpet.com a while back. And it was about some of the rare metals that are needed and are being mined in different places in the earth. This write-up is from Fox News. It says, the critical national security battle the media isn't telling you about. It says, a fascinating battle is shaping up between two American entrepreneurs for control of a desert mine in California that could be the key to reviving domestic production of rare earths, the metals and materials that are critical to our national security. And I guess they're rare, which is why they're called rare earths. But they are essential, as they say, to national security. Haven't heard a lot about this. I do remember that the Trumpets talked about it, and there's some good write-ups there. Haven't heard too much about it in other places. This article from Fox continues. Says, but there's a catch, these two American entrepreneurs. One entrepreneur is linked to a Russian billionaire. The other is relying on a technology company from China. So there is this battle over who owns this mine between these two entrepreneurs. One of them backed by Russia, one of them backed by China. And so these are it is a national security issue potentially, as Fox is saying here. They say that Mountain Pass is an unsightly hole in the earth once owned by a company called Molycorp that produced more critical metals than any facility in the world. Molycorp went bankrupt in 2015 because it could not compete with Chinese rare earth producers who don't have the same environmental regulations that govern U.S. mining. That's something that came up, of course, in the lead-up to the most recent election here in the U.S., all of the regulations that are being put on the United States and some of the manufacturing here, and other nations don't have those yet. And so they're able to have sort of an unfair advantage there in terms of competition. Now, obviously, it'd be good if no one polluted, but that's not the world we're living in right now. China now produces, they say, 95% of the world's rare earths, metals that are needed for U.S. fighter jet engines, satellite-guided rockets, missiles like the Tomahawk cruise that was used to attack Syria last month, and consumer products ranging from computers to iPhones to GPS systems and microwave ovens. And so now that China produces 95% of the world's rare earths, they certainly have a lot of power and a lot of control. That's a major thing. You look at that list that they mentioned there. Obviously, military capabilities, very important things, and then iPhones, which probably caught everybody's attention because most people have an iPhone or a smartphone of some kind. And so relying on one nation to produce 95% of the components needed obviously gives them a huge advantage and could be a problem for the United States. This article from Fox says that our complete mineral reliance on China, which could cut off exports at any time, it's something we don't expect to happen, but what if China did? What if they said, yeah, no more exports? Especially because we're talking about trade wars and that type of thing. We would be in a real tough spot. If they cut off exports at, for any reason, that would threaten our national security. And so these two entrepreneurs who share that concern are offering different visions of how to revive our domestic production. But again, one's backed by Russia, one's backed by China. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that, something that we don't hear about too often, the rare earths. And that's an article from Fox. The critical national security battle the media isn't telling you about. You can read that at foxnews.com. And also, thetrumpet.com's got some good write-ups about that topic as well. lots of things go into national security that sometimes we don't think about. Here's one other story that relates to that as well. Speaking of national security, global security, there was a really good write-up in Time magazines from April 17th, and it's a cover story. The title is "The Uranium Underworld. ISIS Wants a Dirty Bomb, and It Knows Where to Get One." And so it talks about the fact that there's a lot of nuclear material that's out there, and the U.S. is trying to keep tabs on it, but is not able to keep tabs on all of it. Little background here. On December 25th, 1991, that's a very famous date because that's the day that the USSR dissolved. And when that happened, the Soviet Union had approximately 45,000 nuclear weapons, at best estimates anyway. Those were stockpiled at the time of its collapse there in 1991. It had 100 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons, which were unaccounted for, according to government officials. Others within that government said 250 nuclear weapons were unaccounted for. So they didn't know where they were out of those 45,000. And again, that's what the Russian government said, so there's probably some... I don't know if you can trust those numbers exactly, but that's what they said at the time. So that's obviously a major concern. But as Time magazine pointed out, the bigger threat is from that of dirty bombs. And the reason that's such a threat is that, first of all, there's a lot of that material out there. The collapse of the Soviet Union saw large amounts of radioactive material stolen. They don't know where it is, but black trader markets do know, and they are trying to sell it. And one of the things that makes the threat of a dirty bomb maybe more of a threat than, say, a conventional weapon, is that it doesn't take a lot of technological know-how to build one. You don't have to split an atom or get into anything like that. It just takes some of this radioactive material, and there's different types. All it has to do is be packed into a small container with explosives and blown up. And if that happens, it would cause quite a bit of destruction. They say that the initial blast would potentially blow up, a building or something like that. But the radioactivity would pollute all of the building or the area, and probably one or two to maybe more city blocks if it was done in a city. Then it depends also on the wind. If the wind's blowing and it's going a certain direction, it's going to spread that contaminated air. And so, as we've seen with terrorist attacks in different places, airports and such, a lot of emergency responders and other people come in after the blast to try to help. Well, you have to think that all those people coming to help then would be encountering this radioactive material. Maybe they'd be prepared for it. Maybe they'd be suited up. Maybe they wouldn't be. I don't know how soon they'd be able to tell that. But so that's one of the big threats. And you can think about, and I think from the reports here from Time talk about, the fact that it would take months to decontaminate an area. So if that was done at an airport, a major world airport, you wouldn't be able to use that for months. So what kind of financial impact would that have on, everybody? Because those hubs are used by so many different nations for traveling. So there is a real threat of that. And again, this isn't like something people aren't aware of. It's one of the top stories in Time here recently. But it is worth considering. And so they're potentially, well, this radioactive material is out there on the black market. Dirty bombs, like we mentioned there, they don't require a lot of technical know-how, and radioactive uranium can be found in many places, including hospitals and other facilities. When ISIS came into Iraq, I guess it was a year or two ago, they took over, they got a hold of some material, but thankfully it wasn't at the level needed for a dirty bomb. So I'm not sure of all the technical differences there, but according to Time, they weren't able to use that. But they, that shows how close they are to getting some of these weapons. The situation that was brought up here in this Time magazine article, again, it's the cover story from April 17th, the Uranium Underworld. It follows the example of one individual that was trying to sell some of this radioactive material and got caught, thankfully. They stopped him. But the fear is, obviously, that they're not going to catch everybody. Three different smugglers were caught last year trying to sell uranium on the black market to be used for a dirty bomb. And those are the ones, of course, they caught. Were there others that weren't caught? That we don't know, I guess. One was caught in Georgia, the nation of Georgia. And that's part of what's called the nuclear highway through Russia that goes from the Caucasus Mountains to Iran, Turkey, and then to ISIS territory in Syria and Iraq. So if you're familiar with that geography or if you're looking at a map, you know that route. And that's the what they're calling the nuclear highway at this time because they're not able to regulate what's going through those areas. Some of those areas aren't even being really governed. There's a sort of a middle ground there where all sorts of things happen, and it's just ruled by basically local mobs. Now, in the one particular case mentioned here in this Time magazine article, unknown persons delivered the uranium inside a sack of scrap metal to a junkyard. And that's the story, anyway, that this smuggler gave when he got caught. But he took the small little box full of this uranium. I think it was about this, you know, it was very small. He could carry it in his hands. And he was going to sell it for several million dollars. And for the people living in that area, I think in this case it was in Georgia, they're obviously struggling to survive financially. So they are more than willing in some cases to sell this material for millions of dollars. And so it is a real threat, and it is a problem that the U.S. is trying to track. The United States has poured a lot of money into trying to solve this problem. The U.S. has spent $50 million to set up anti-smuggling teams in former Soviet republics, and all along what they call, again, this nuclear highway. And this smuggling route that the U.S. has installed nuclear detectors at the borders of the nations of that route. So we were able to, the U.S. was able to track when this radioactive material was passing across the borders. That's how they were trying to keep track of what was coming out of that former Soviet areas and then down through that nuclear highway. But there was a problem with that, a couple of problems. One, that $50 million that comes basically from the U.S. through U.N. funding. So if we do pull back on our U.N. support, which I think a lot of people want to do in the United States, there are areas where that money is really protecting people, protecting all of us, and this is one of those cases. $50 million spent to try to prevent the smuggling there in the Soviet republics. I mean, that's how they caught this one fellow that they talk about in the Time magazine cover story, because the U.S. had funded these anti-smuggling teams that caught the guy. But again, they had these detectors set up on the borders of these nations along this what they call nuclear highway coming out of Russia and then going down into the Middle East. And but the Russian war in eastern Ukraine back in 2014, as I think we all remember that destroyed 29 border radiation detectors. And so those have not been replaced, at least according at the time of the writing of the Time magazine article. So they don't know exactly what's going through those areas. 29 border radiation detectors destroyed in that war, the Russian war in eastern Ukraine in 2014. And so, and then, of course, Russian President Vladimir Putin, he's not been the biggest fan of the United States probably ever, but especially these days. And he told the U.S. he doesn't need their help anymore in tracking some of that. And so they have a fear, too, because there have been terrorist attacks in Russia. Of course, when that occurs, it's sort of hard to determine who's behind it in some cases, but that's a very real threat. The article is the top story on Times magazine from April 17th, the Uranium Underworld. ISIS wants a dirty bomb and knows where to get one. So that's just sort of a synopsis of that article. And it does highlight a very real threat that is out there, and pretty interesting to take a look at that. And, of course, they've got some good photos of the people involved and so forth. So if you get a chance to check that out, it might be worth doing it. They have a good map, too, of that nuclear highway. There, Georgia being right below Russia and leading into Turkey and other places. And, of course, we've seen Syria use chemical weapons recently as well. So definitely some of those leaders are willing to do it if it gets into their hands. Pretty frightening scenario. That is possible and probably worth paying a little bit of attention to. Again, that's from Time magazine. Make sure you listen for the Kia David program. That's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet daily radio show today with your host, Richard Palmer, filling in for Stephen Fleury. And also the Trumpet Hour program. Again, a really interesting interview today, and something you're going to want to hear related to the Soviet Union as well. A conversation with a former communist, Eugene Yelchin, and he's written a book. It's a children's book. It's for young people. Yeah, it's called Breaking Stalin's Nose, and which is a very interesting and captivating title, I think, a curiosity-invoking title. And it's sort of a fiction book, but also related to his upbringing and to the experience that he had with communism, and which is something that has been in the news a lot lately. So it's really interesting. Make sure you listen for that. That's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Or you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. It's available there as well. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. Two of the main stories, or the main story is 40% of Germans agree with anti-Semitic statement and sentiment statement. Yeah, and then the next related one is never show that you are a Jew, an old and new reality in Germany. And so those are some of the top stories there at thetrumpet.com as well. So make sure you do listen for that. Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live today. That's all the time that we have. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, thanks for spending some of your Wednesday with us. Enjoy the rest of the day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.